Hello, hello.
I am.
Hello, hello, hello. All right.
How are you?
Yeah, very good. A lot of radio, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Very good. Oh, so who have you had? Am I first, or have you had...
Vincent.
You've had Vincent.
Well, what are you doing St. Patrick's Day? That's a real question.
I know, it's St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, no, well, I come from an Irish family, so it's a great... yeah. It's a great tradition. I had a great St. Patrick's Day once in New York, which I remember nothing of, which is always a good sign. I know I was in New York. I know it was St. Patrick's Day, and then I know it wasn't St. Patrick's Day. And that's all I remember.
Now, you know the tradition, if you don't wear green, you get pinched, right?
Is that right? I didn't know that, no. No.
So you didn't get to edit this until after the summer 2012 Olympics.
Was
that favorable for a film that clearly involved a whole lot of thinking?
Yes. It was actually, we didn't anticipate that at the time. And I was concerned when we stopped. It was always a danger. We were very lucky to be able to do it. Not many filmmakers get that chance to put a film on ice. Usually only if the actors have to change shape, like Tom Hanks in Castaway or De Niro, obviously famously in Raging Bull. But... I was a bit concerned because you thought, I'll never be able to forget it. But you do forget, which is a curious thing, given the idea of the film anyway. You do forget. Other things fill in the brain. So when we came to sit down and watch it after the Olympics had finished, we watched the rough cut before we started working on editing it. It was like weird. It was like I couldn't remember what was coming next. Whereas as a director, you know too much all the time. So it was very useful to have that refresher course in the impact of the story the first time you hear it. So it was a help, yeah, in the end, certainly.
I just want to say congratulations on the film. I absolutely loved it.
Oh, cool.
Thank you. I was saying, as soon as the movie ended, I really wanted them to just roll it again.
Well, that's one of the things about doing a film like this that I've learned, that I've never really done it on any other film. You have to make it, and it has to make sense the second time people watch it. It's really important. Not that they're definitely going to watch it a second time, but you can tell whether it will make... even as you're watching it and you don't know what's happening, there's part of you is also sort of watching... what will it be? Will it make sense a second time? I don't understand that clue, but it clearly is a clue. There's something there. And obviously, if I went back and watched it again, that would make sense. So it's got a weird kind of thing like that. And the first time we did it, you're very protective of the secrets. So you kind of give no clues at all, and you have to relax and let people in. There's a little clue here and a little clue here. So we cut in him knocking on glass like he's locked. Because obviously that's symbolic, really, of, I don't know, the executive in his brain saying, no, Simon, this is not right. There's something not quite right here. And he's kind of trying to punch his way out, really. So you put in little clues, which weren't there in the script. You put them in to kind of let people feel satisfied the second time, you know.
What did you love about directing the film?
Well, this one, actually, funnily enough, I loved... you don't sense it so much in the film because we illustrated the trances, and that was always the idea. But there is a performance of the film where Rosario talks you through each of the trances, because that's what she's doing. Although you see him... so, for instance, you see him in the French countryside. She talks that whole sequence through, and you come to a church, and in the church there's this, and there's painting, and there's a Rembrandt is there, and then there's this girl, and your own personal audio guide, and she talks you, and you can't do it as a movie, because it's more like a radio play, but it was wonderful, because she learned these bloody speeches, and I feel very guilty, because she learned, I mean, like the most enormous speeches. And I said, you've got to learn them all because I want to be able to use a tiny bit of it at certain points, but I'm not sure which bit it is. And we'll replace the whole thing eventually with the story, with the actual, with what you're saying. So most critically, there's that one where she, and obviously if you knew this, you'd understand what was going on, but hopefully you don't, which is that when she puts him in, when she appears naked in front of him and puts him in trance, and then he's kind of wakes up the next morning and he goes and gets the gun from Vincent. He gets trapped inside Vincent's apartment. Obviously, she's talking him through the whole of that. She's telling him that story. He's just sitting there, and she's saying, and now you do this, and you go to the drawer, and you open, oh, not that drawer, you open the other drawer, and in the drawer is a gun, and you take the gun, and it makes you feel like you're safe, and you can have power over these evil, you know, and that, there's that version of the script, of the story, which you'll never see. It's a kind of radio version, and it was amazing, you know, hearing her talk, because a lot of it, of course, hypnosis is about the reassurance of the human voice. Telling you, finding things out about you and kind of reassuring you and welcoming you and relaxing you and taking you somewhere else. So that, I love that version of it. And I mean, I love all the pirate, all the visceral stuff as well. But it'd be, people would be surprised how much I love that version of it, you know.
Do you have any personal experience with hypnosis that made this, making this movie and being involved with this material that made it a double whammy for you? Or were you just finding out as you went along?
We were finding out. I mean, any film director has a relationship with hypnosis. Because if you make a decent film, that's what you've done. You've hypnotized the audience. And especially in the old days when, because the images are not moving. They're static. We know that. You know, they're 24 still images. But you are deluded into making them move. You make them move. So, and if you make a good one, you know that feeling where you get lost in a movie and the real world just goes out the window and you're like believing and crying because somebody's dying. I mean, it's ludicrous, but that's hypnosis, really. You believe that you're somewhere else doing something else. I didn't have any personal kind of medical experience of it.
No giving up smoking or anything like that?
No, nothing like that.
Lose weight, something?
No, I've never done anything. I've never had to do. Directors are control freaks. You don't really relax enough to be able to go under. You're kind of like, you're always trying to control everything, you know, it's like, that's the nature of the job. But we did find out some interesting stuff about it because it was very, and that was, I really enjoyed researching it. And the idea, we'd had the idea for a long time and I'd always wanted to make it. And she, what we found out was that it was, for a while, hypnosis was growing as a acceptable, admissible, legal tool and medical tool. You could use it in court cases. And then it got discredited because it was proved that people were claiming like child abuse and these memories had been planted in them. And it got discredited. And so since then, and that was in the 70s, I think, since then they've been trying to rebuild its reputation. So there's this idea that they have around that when you are hypnotized, you're not really asleep. You'll always be awake. You'll be aware of where you are and you'll never do anything you don't want to do. And that's true for about 80, 85% of the population. The rest of the population, as it says in the film, and it's absolutely true, the 5 to 10% are highly suggestible. And they can be taken somewhere. So what happens to James in the film, although it's ethically completely unacceptable, it is medically possible. And they don't really want to own up to that because it does reveal its power. And it is, there's a danger in that as well. You know, there's clearly a danger. And those are the kind of people, when you go and see a show, those are the people that they pick out, that the hypnotists pick out. So they don't pick out actors who are faking it, which is what I always used to think. They pick out, they have a series of exercises early on in the show. And they're picking out the people who are like this. And they are the 5 to 10%. They get them up on stage and they often get them up and go, no, this isn't going to work. And they put them back in. They can tell who these people are. So that when they put them in trance, it's genuine. So they, and there are restrictions because you can abuse it, of course. People can get up to all sorts of sexual antics. There are restrictions on what they're allowed to do. You know, there's no nudity or anything like, you know, it's all there because it clearly has a power. So it was wonderful researching it like that. And Rosario did quite a bit of research as well on it. So,
well, can you talk about the evolution of the script that Joe or Ahern came to copy, and then you went to your standby guy, John Hodge?
Yeah.
What did that first draft look like that you got? Was it convoluted? Because the movie itself feels quite convoluted. What was that process going from Joe to
Well, John was a doctor. When we did Shallowgrave and Trainspotting, he was a practicing doctor. And there is something extraordinary about them that you get because they when they're practicing doctors, he was an emergency doctor, you know, in A&E. And they see drama, like, unbelievable. They see us at our most vulnerable, when we're hurt, when we're damaged, or when we're with someone who is hurt and damaged. And they... I think it's why doctors make such good writers, because they have a kind of distance on human drama. And John brought a lot of that knowledge to the script in this case. So, for instance, there's an MRI scene, a strange scene in the MRI scanner, where she talks to him about his memories and tells us about what we are, which is very true. We string together a series of memories, and that is us. That's our identity. And when you lose it, like sadly in Alzheimer's, everybody says, you know, the person just disappears. The physical embodiment is still there, but they've gone. They're no longer there. So he brought all that to it as well. And also a love of the thriller genre, you know, playing with people, the game, really. So he brought a lot of that to it. And we worked on it for a couple of years after Slumdog, actually. And we were going to make it in Manhattan with an English actress. We always thought that she should be from somewhere else. She should have nobody to be able to fall back on. And then when we got the Olympic Games, we thought, no, we should make it in London because the cities don't matter, really. It's a city where crime can happen, you know, where a bubble can exist that people get sealed inside. And so we decided to make it in London, and then we came here to look for the actress, you know, to play. I don't think you guys get this, but for us in Britain, it's fantastic because you get a whole Californian thing going on with the hypnotherapy and that idea of, which we think of in Britain, which is, well, Californians just talk until the, you know, all sorts of problems can be talked about and just like talk through therapy. It's great. Everybody's got a therapist. You know, that whole world, you get all that free with Rosario. I mean, I know that doesn't apply here, but that's an extra bonus you get in Britain, which is very funny, you know. So.
And most of the best way to see this movie, obviously, is to go in seeing nothing.
Yeah, no knowing spoilers, nothing, yeah.
No spoilers. How, in today's digital age, do you convince people to go in to see this movie without giving too much away?
It's impossible, isn't it? I mean, it's impossible. You've got to sell the movie. Otherwise, in the marketplace, the movie will just disappear because nobody knows about it. Blah, 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 blah. So, and as soon as people know about it, they want to know a bit about it. It's a natural inclination. My only hope, and I genuinely believe this, and I've believed it for a long time, actually, is that I think there is an amnesiac effect in cinema, curiously enough. Is that I think I know when I go in and I know from spoilers stuff about it, I forget it. Once it's running, I do forget it, you know, because I know. And it's like, it's been built into cinema anyway. You know Tom Cruise isn't going to die. You know, don't you? But it doesn't go, it isn't a barrier to you. You kind of go, oh my God, he might die. And then he gets away. It's like ludicrous, but true. And so I think there is that kind of, and maybe it's linked to hypnosis and the hypnotic effect of cinema. But I think you do, so I hope that applies really, because obviously there's a lot of materials out there with a thing like this that will, if you take the materials very seriously, won't allow you to have that innocence walking in, which would be ideal, you know. So, yeah, we'll see. Who knows? You know.
Do you think there's too much emphasis on the what as opposed to the how? You know what I mean? I feel like, oh, don't tell what's going to happen. But a lot of times the same things happen again and again in movies. And it's more of how it's...
How you get there, yeah. I think that's probably true as well. There's only so many stories, aren't there? And there's only so many things you can do. And in fact, it's one of the weird things for me is I realise, because you obviously you do promotion like this and you look back at the movies you've made, and I basically make the same movie every single time. There's a guy and he faces insurmountable odds and he somehow manages to get over those insurmountable odds and it's okay. So you get a lift at the end. The difference with this movie is that it's not a guy. Because if you tell the story in chronological order, you see who faces insurmountable odds. It's her. She is... Her life is ruined, potentially ruined. She's in, you know, her only option is to run away, which she refuses to do. This violent man walks back into her life, which she knows on some level he will do anyway. And not only that, he's got four other violent guys with him now. And that is the insurmountable odds. And she decides to face it. And she actually overcomes it. So it's basically the same movie. But how you get to it is hopefully make people real. Fool people into thinking it isn't the same movie. Yeah.
Most of your films have something that I'd almost say approximates spirituality, whether it's fate or premonition or a guiding force. And this is the first of your films that I can remember that takes that away. It's out, like that. It's not outside of a human.
Yes.
You placed it. Yeah. That guiding force is a human.
So, yeah.
And you placed it. Is there, were you, has there been a point or a shift, like ideologically or just artistically or as a direction? Did you just want a new challenge? What made you kind of decide that, or what was the impulse that drove you towards that?
I think it's probably, I think the truth is on this one, we'd come off a run where we'd made Slumdog, 127 Hours, and we'd the Olympic Games, which is a very kind of redemptive movies, really. But they are, and the Olympic Games is a celebration of that spirit, you know, of it's a family thing and it's kind of like a pride thing. And I suppose what we were doing is that we were making what we call the evil twin sister of those kind of in this movie, which is kind of delicious, a bit deranged, and a bit kind of messing with you, really. And it's like our relaxation of that part of our brain. You know, you keep that part of your brain active while you're doing all this other work. There are connections, though. There are kind of, which illustrate how different it is again, I suppose. Because the last couple of films have been about memories, really. I mean, Slumdog is about memories and how you can achieve almost like a karmic good fortune with them. And 127 is absolutely a memory film where the memories of his family offer him redemption and actually drive him to achieve his redemption and to get out of there, to get back to them. But this is about the havoc that's caused, the devastation that's wreaked by the use of memories, the inappropriate use of memories or the interference with memories, if you like. So there's sort of things that link them all. But this is not more noirish when there is no God.
Yeah.
There really is no God. I mean, that's the part of the noir deal, isn't it? Yeah. There's just us, and we are locked in our own bubble, destroying ourselves in the attempt to get power over each other. You know, it's like...
Do you sometimes in the morning when you're brushing your teeth and looking in the mirror, do you go, oh, my God, I have an Oscar, and I directed the Olympics?
No, but I did use... The Oscars were very useful during the Olympics, believe me. And the number of times I hit people over the head with them. Because it's not... Seriously, you have to. I normally don't kind of... You know, I don't think about them a great deal because they are a very... they slightly unbalance your life if you think about them too much. So I don't keep it on show. I have it under the bed. Because you can't get up in... No, I'm serious. You can't get up in the morning. And that's the first thing you see. It's just like, oh, my God. It's like... So, but I did use them to bash people on the International Olympic Committee over the head with them. Yeah, you basically go, look, all right, if you want to do it like that, I'm going to resign. And they go, oh, because then they think, oh, shit, that'll be in the newspapers and the Oscar winner has resigned, has walked away and it'll look like it's my fault. Oh, all right, then. And you sort of get what you want. You know, you have to be shameless using them like that. So.
Danny, I was going to ask you, you're equally at home doing television and film.
Yes.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of both?
I think television is more like it's more a writer's medium, really, where you can get a familiarity with a character over a long period of time. It is more like whereas I think movies are more like an event. Well, you want something, there's a reason to go to a dark room with all these strangers and kind of sit there mesmerised, hopefully, for 19 minutes or 2 hours. Whereas television is more like part of your life, an ongoing conversation that you have with the characters. And I think that suits writers particularly. Whereas I'm a kind of an event man, you know, which I think is one of the reasons that we fitted so well with the Olympic thing. I like the event, like doing something special for you. You know, that is all embracing. And whether you consider it afterwards, whether you dwell on it and think about it afterwards, that's up to you. You know, sometimes you hope people do, but it's not necessary. What's necessary is to be involved in the event, you know, to go through that process with all the people in the cinema. Whereas I think telly's more like an ongoing part of your life that you're constantly kind of, it's like a diary, isn't it, that you're kind of like talking with. hence people's addiction now to, you know, 12-parters and the growing trend there'll be of you buy up the box sets and you just sit there overdosing on them at a weekend, you know, going through, you can't stop watching these characters. I mean, it's like, so I think that's the main, I guess that's the main difference.
You'd be great on the first date.
Why?
That's it, though. Everything else would be downhill.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, no, maybe. No, that's probably
you
right.
You talk about porno, your next picture. Is it a bookend to Trainspotting? Or, you know, how closely will it be related? Or is it dissimilar?
No, it's very, it's, you should think of it as Trainspotting 2. Because although it won't be an adaptation of the book Porno, which what it'll be more is an examination of those actors and their characters. It'll be the same actors, the same characters, 20 years later. So it's a wonderfully acute way of looking at these guys who, in their mid, early 20s, what you can get away with, the risks you can take, just like unbelievable. We've all done it. And you get in your 40s and the osteoarthritis begins to set in and they're kind of like, it's not quite so easy, you know? And it'll be classic. It'll be them looking at their... It's like that program, 7 up, 14 up, you know, 21 up. They'll be looking at what have they made of their lives in 20 years. You know, it'll be cruel and yet hopefully very moving because you'll have a double reflex to it because the characters, which everybody remembers, Begbie and Spud and Sigmund, will be 20 years older. They'll look 20 years older. The actor will also be 20 years older because you'll... And you watching it, if you've seen it the first time, you'll think, wow, where did that 20 years go? Because it's like, you know... So we're not doing it next. It's we're working on it, though, so that hopefully by... We'd be able to release it like 2016, which would be 2015, 2016, which is a 20-year... kind of marker for it, really. So,
you have all the same cast?
Yeah, no, we're not guaranteed. When the script is finished, we will send it to them. We'll do everything we can to get them. That depends on them. They're, you know, they haven't signed a deal to do a sequel. You know, that wasn't in the original contract because nobody thought, you know, it would live on like this. You know, I mean, it's like, yeah, so.
Okay, can you
sign
this
one? Yes, of course,
thank
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's right.
Well, no, but you do worry that they are the same. That's what you finish them. You think, oh, it's the same movie. I thought it was going to be so different. It's the same movie.
Is it all just high fives and smiles on set all the time?
Not quite. Not quite. No, and we're not like that anyway. And the Brits aren't sort of like that anyway. We're a bit more cynical than that. But we tried in the opening ceremony to abandon that cynicism and to enjoy the fact that we're a modern progressive country, and that's a decent thing. And you've got to say that about us, and I mean this about America as well, because we often criticise ourselves and everybody get, you know, and there's a self-critical side of us which is really, really important. But also, when you do something like the Olympic ceremony, there's a lot of foreigners come to be part of it, and they look at, like, New York and London, and it's a beacon for them. They think that a chance to live in a city where you can be yourself, whatever that self is, you know, you can make something of yourself, is a wonderful thing. And we wanted to celebrate the fact that despite all our problems with our pasts and stuff like that, we are a modern progressive nation and we should keep progressing, you know, keep evolving like that, really. So it was nice to be able to do that. But normally we are a bit more cynical. I mean, it's not much high-fiving at all.
It was such a contrast to the Beijing, which was extraordinary in its own.
Yes, it was, wasn't it? But no, what had happened is really since the one here, since 1984, the Los Angeles, the only ceremonies had become competitive. They spent more money. Each one spent more money, and they got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then Beijing, of course, was like, they weren't going to be outdone by anybody. It was like... impossible. So we thought, right, we'll just start again. That's quite liberating, really.
It was great.
Cool. Well, thanks very much.
I had no idea what was going on, but I knew I liked it.
Thanks so much, everyone. See you again. Bye-bye.